Hey guys, welcome to the show. We have a absolutely fantastic episode planned for you today. We are bringing Alan Donegan on, and then for the first time on the Choose FI podcast, The Escape Artist. I kid you not when I say that this is probably the best financial independence blog that you haven't heard of, especially to our American audience. I have been just pouring through The Escape Artist content over the last several weeks, and it is incredibly good stuff. So this is an episode that I think is going to hold a lot of appeal, but I wanted to set the stage and say that we're doing this episode because we got a request from a listener. And I'm going to play that request right after this.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys, welcome back. To start this episode off, we're going to play a voicemail that we got from Sarah.
Hi, I know that you're from America, but I'm sure you have lots of readers all over the world. My name's Sarah. I'm from England, just outside of London. And I wondered if maybe you could get in contact with like a specialist finance FI kind of person in England and do an interview with them about how to achieve FI in their country, in our country, because I still think it would be really interesting for those people in America who are interested in maybe moving abroad for tax reasons and for FI reasons, for living costs and things like that, and to get an overview of what it would be like to live in different countries, tax reasons especially. And I was thinking that that would be really interesting. Also, a podcast that we have over here that it's quite good is Meaningful Money, Pete Matthews. He's a bit English, so he's probably a little bit boring if you listen to him, but not for us boring English people, because we don't really, we're not so happy when we do podcasts. But although he's not FI, he's certainly still down to earth, and he knows everything about the financial situation in England. And that would be really helpful. So there you are. That's my suggestion. Thank you.
So Brad and I got this voicemail and we were so blown away and excited. And we had to look at each other and say, I don't know any FI experts that could help us do this UK path to FI, except Alan Donegan, who is not a stranger to this podcast. So we reached out to Alan and he agreed to join us to help share his perspective on what this path would actually look like. But he had a suggestion. He said, I am actually friends with The Escape Artist, who has a blog over at theescapeartist.me. And I was new to Barney, who also has the moniker The Escape Artist. I was new to his blog, but it blew me away. And so we knew after looking into that, that yes, we wanted Alan to come on the show, but we had to have The Escape Artist come on as well. And so we have made the introductions. We made that happen. We've coordinated it. And now Alan and Barney are here today to share their story. And I am incredibly excited for this episode.
Yeah. So Sarah asked in her voicemail for an expert, and we have two. And with that, welcome Barney and Alan to the podcast.
I'm looking forward to this.
Hi, guys. It's an absolute pleasure.
So, Alan, is there any interesting story on how you met Barney?
Yeah. So I was introduced to Barney's blog by a friend who sent us a link to it as an English resource. And my wife read the whole thing from beginning to an end. We got very excited about it. And then Barney actually offers some coaching in England to people who want to get to FI. And my wife and I looked at it. He lives not far from where we live, so we booked an hour's coaching. We went to Barney's house, he made us coffee, and we sat there talking for an hour and a half about how we could get to FI, and that really helped my wife and I's journey on doing that.
What's so amazing, Barney, about your blog is, honestly, I had no idea that it existed. And then when I found it as a result of that conversation, this is the first time in a long time that I've done this, but I started with the first article and I just started reading my way through it. And I couldn't stop. It was that awesome.
Fantastic. It's great to hear.
And you've been writing since at least for the last 2 years, maybe 3 years. Is that right?
Yeah, I started just over 3 years ago, and I started in my notice period. So when I started the blog, I had just recently got to financial independence and I'd handed my notice in. And so I was still sat at work, but with not that much to do. And so one of the ways that I kept myself occupied and amused during my notice period was to start producing some of those blog articles. And, you know, in those early days, the content just tumbled out of my head and onto the paper. I was writing an article almost every day at one point, because it was essentially 20 years of knowledge, 20 years of discovery, 20 years of pain, 20 years of frustration kind of tumbling down onto the paper or onto my keyboard. And so for me, writing the blog was just very cathartic. It was a way of kind of organizing my thoughts. It was a way of me transitioning or helping myself to transition from a full-on job in finance to being financially independent. And so it was free therapy for myself. And also by sticking it out there into the world, I did have the hope that some other people might benefit from it along the way. It always struck me as amazing that there were these incredible resources, this community, this subculture in the USA, and almost nothing in the UK as regards financial independence. So I guess my blog was just an attempt to try and redress that a bit.
And redress it you did. I am curious, what was that moment for you? When did you actually discover this subculture? And was there any sort of transition in how you were managing your finances? Or were you already kind of on the path just without knowing it?
I was on that path for years and years and years without even knowing that financial independence was a thing. You know, I'd never heard of Your Money or Your Life or The Millionaire Next Door. You know, I was just blithely working, earning, saving, learning about investing, and being this kind of sort of strange person doing it without an example. Now, in about somewhere around 2000, I stumbled across in a bookshop across an obscure book called Invest in Yourself. And I just picked it up in the bookshop and I started reading it. And it was talking about, you know, how much is enough and can you cut your expenses and the wonders of compound interest. But it wasn't really a full-on financial independence book, a la Your Money or Your Life, for example. But those concepts, they grabbed me and I picked that book up. I bought it. I took it home. I read it again and again and put some of those lessons into my life. I also, a couple of years later, had a job where I wasn't happy at all. And that really forced me to think about, you know, how long did I want to do all this? And it forced me to get serious about my personal finances and saving. And I got my expenses way down and I got my savings rate way up. And just carried on like that for a number of years until in 2003, I stumbled across the Moneyvator blog in the UK, which is all about investing and with a kind of a sub-theme of financial independence, but it's an investing-led blog. The authors produce a very useful weekly roundup of links to other sites, and they introduced me to the magic of Mr. Money Moustache, and I found that blog and I devoured it. You know, I must have driven the page views stats up that day because I just read and read and read and was absolutely kind of captivated by it.
What year did you find MMM?
2013.
Okay.
Bernie, I'm curious if you could go back to the start. So you've been, you know, talking about being a little bit different for 20 years, or at least going back to 2000 when you found that book. But could you just for the audience compare and contrast yourself with the average citizen of England or the UK or Europe or wherever? You know, like what sets you apart? Because, you know, we all know, the people listening know what keeping up with the Joneses is like here in the US, where you see your neighbor getting an expensive house, an expensive car, and the people try to keep up with that. What is it like in the UK? What is the savings rate like? Just give us a background of that. And then what sets you apart?
Okay. So it's a great question. And let me go back to the start. You know, I was brought up in the middle of nowhere, in a tiny little village in rural England, in East Anglia, in a county called Cambridgeshire. And nothing ever happened there. And because it was a rural area, there wasn't actually that much keeping up with the Joneses. There wasn't that much consumerism. It was kind of a really sort of low-key place. But I did notice in those kind of early years that my parents, they both were salaried middle-class professionals. So my mother was a teacher. My dad worked for a building company. He was a surveyor. And they worked hard. They commuted. They had long commutes each day. And they often, you know, came home late, tired, with all these kind of war stories about what had gone on in the office. And they were very conventional. So they did the classic thing of getting up the property ladder. So they bought the biggest house that they could afford. They stretched themselves on the mortgage. And, you know, in 1981, we moved. They took on a bigger mortgage. And shortly after that happened, interest rates were raised to 17% by the government to try and tackle inflation at the time. And my parents had to seriously tighten their belts. So they essentially cancelled the newspapers. My dad stopped buying beer. He started to brew his own beer. Our holidays got cancelled. And that, if you like, was a kind of an early lesson for me in a couple of things. One is kind of the evils of excessive debt and, you know, the fact that ultimately, if you don't keep up those mortgage payments, they can take the house away from you. And also, it was a salutary example that if push comes to shove, if you really kind of put yourself into it, it's amazing how much you can take out of your cost base, how much you can take out of your spending if you've got a compelling enough reason to do so. So that was a very kind of salient example for me. But also at the same time, I'd seen in my, you know, in my childhood, in this village that I lived in, that there was this rich family there. And they, again, I'd never heard of the idea of financial independence, but they had a huge house. They had lots of farmland. They had antique paintings. You know, they had investments, they had stocks, and they didn't need to go to work. You know, they just ran that farm. And they were, if you like, the first example I'd seen of people that were rich and didn't need to go to an office. They didn't need to commute. They didn't need to answer to anyone. They didn't need to take any nonsense from a boss. And so that I was always kind of fascinated by that example. Then later on, I went to school. I went to college, and at college, I lived very frugally, as everyone does at university in the UK. So I lived on about £3,000 a year. And then when I got a job as an accountant in London, my first proper job, it was this weird thing happened. So my income went up from, say, £3,000 a year to £12,000 a year. And yet I was broker. You know, I was more broke when I was working than I was when I was a student because, living in London, getting your own place, you know, the temptations that brings you to kind of go out and all these kind of leisure opportunities that are suddenly available to you and your spending kind of goes through the roof. And so, again, that was a really early taster of lifestyle inflation for me. And so that was my job was an accountant. So I guess that makes me slightly unusual. I don't claim to be a normal kind of representative member of the public. You know, most people are just not that interested in money. And I've always been interested in money. I've always had this kind of fear of ending up poor or homeless or having my house taken away from me, probably because of that example I saw my parents when they were overleveraged. And so I've always had this kind of fascination and this fear of poverty, but also this interest in, could you get to a point where you no longer had to commute, you no longer had to answer to a boss, and you no longer had any money worries? That to me was kind of my nirvana, my kind of dream. But I had no role model, no example to show me that was possible. And that's what we've really lacked here in the UK.
Both of you guys have made some somewhat unconventional choices in your late 30s, early 40s. And Alan, I'd be curious to hear your take on what Barney was just telling us and whether or not you have a different perspective on that.
So there was a study done by one of the big insurance companies in England about 8 months ago, and they found that one in four UK families have less than £95 in savings, which, to put that into context, that's about $120 in the bank. The average person doesn't particularly save in this country. And I think the culture is, you get a job, you inflate your lifestyle, you buy a nicer car, you buy a nicer house. I don't think people understand why I still live in a two-bed flat. Even my family-in-law said, when are you going to move into a proper house? And that culture of spending more money is definitely strong here. Keeping up with the Joneses, spending more money, having nicer cars. And people just don't get why you wouldn't spend money and what you're doing with it.
So, Alan, your family, have they been made aware? You just said, I guess your wife Katie's parents are wondering when you're going to move into a proper house. Like, do you talk to them about financial independence? Has this ever come up? Talk us through the conversation of what that's like when you speak to your family, to your friends about financial independence. Is it, do people look at you like you're crazy even still?
Yes. That's the short answer. Nice. It's been really quite challenging. They don't get it. And actually, like a really recent example of this, my wife has just finished contracting and we're kind of getting there. And actually, she's decided to finish working and she's going to do some stuff she loves. She's going to learn a bit of data science. She's going to help me with my business. And she's decided to keep fit by doing a bit of Deliveroo delivering. So sharing food around the place and going cycling to make £6 an hour. And when we told the family that, they didn't get it. The questions were unbelievable. And even one of the statements was, they were saying to Katie, what a waste of a good education. And that it's not a waste of a good education. We're doing exactly what we want to do in life, which is learn, keep fit, have an incredible life, talking to amazing people, traveling. We're doing exactly what we want to do in life, but it's not understood. It really isn't understood. And if you're not at work, something's wrong. And I think dealing with that in those family communications and how people look at you is really tough. My family don't particularly get me. I think my brother does more. He kind of understands it, but he lives the total opposite lifestyle. And it's really tough. It's really tough. And actually, I hang out more with the FI community because I'm hanging out with a load of people who get me. And you can have open conversations about what do you want to do other than what's your next promotion or where's your next holiday.
Is there a thriving FI community that you have locally or anywhere in the UK that you can actually get together with people, you know, face to face?
There is. So for me, there is an FI London group on Facebook. I don't really connect with them because after putting on the UK Chautauqua this year, I shared it in the FI London group and I got a lot of abuse because it was reasonably expensive. And mainly it's been a few friends, like meeting Barney and like meeting a couple of other people in the UK that I hang out with. But I've not found a real strong community to connect with. Barney might have a completely different opinion to that.
So there is not a strong financial independence movement or culture or really community in the UK. Now, I mean, Alan mentioned the London FI Facebook group. That's a relatively recent creation. And I think it's a positive step. There's some good guys and girls in that group. And I have actually, you know, gone to a few of the meetups and there are some really lovely people there. And it's kind of a breath of fresh air to have those conversations and have those meetups, which were modeled a bit on the Mr. Money Moustache type meetups. So that has been positive, but it's tiny. You know, we're talking about tiny numbers of people. So in that Facebook group, there's 500 members and there's 10 million people live in London. There's 70 million people in the UK and there's 500 members of that Facebook group. So it really gives you a sense for how small the movement is. And for example, there are no UK equivalent books to Your Money or Your Life. There's no UK equivalent books to The Millionaire Next Door. The culture doesn't really exist over here other than a handful of blogs that have a pretty narrow readership base.
That to me sounds like an opportunity then, right? I think I know someone who has a pop-up business school who can maybe help with the startup, right?
Well, it's funny. When I stumbled across the Mr. Money Moustache site, I actually wrote a guest post for Pete and sent it to him, emailed it kind of unsolicited saying, look, here's an article about financial independence outside of the US and in the UK and kind of the differences between them. And he emailed back and he was kind enough to say, you should definitely start a blog in the UK. It's probably a great opportunity. So I kind of took that advice and that's part of the reason I did what I did.
You know, we referred to FI as this subculture, but honestly, the strand I see in our community is, what if everybody ends up doing this? Does this still work? And the reason for that is because it's such a common sense choice. You know, when you think about the traditional model of what life should actually look like and you break it down, the first 30% of your life is basically set aside for the educational process. And that's going to more or less remain static across the board. I mean, there's probably some progressive people out there that have figured out how to tweak it at the margins, but more or less that's kind of locked in. But what's so interesting about our community is we really focus on the second leg of the journey. We focus on the working career. How long do you need to be tied to your 9-to-5 for? And while the traditional model says the next 50 some odd percent of your life is going to be tied to your job, and then you're allowed to have this small sliver at the end to do with what you want, to enjoy the quote unquote golden years, FI just flips that on its head and says, no, let's jack up the savings rate. Let's shrink that work period into a much smaller window of time. And then obviously that's going to open up this post-work period of time to really pursue the things that you get excited about. That would be the deck that I would want to choose from.
Yes. And actually, like, you might minimize down the working period, but there's no reason why you can't even enjoy that as well. So you spend 30% education, you really enjoy your 20% working, and then you're free as well. So I think there's no reason to put off having fun until retirement. You might as well enjoy life along the way. And if you've got an infinite choice of jobs and things to do, choose one that you enjoy.
And what I love about having both of you on the phone is that, Alan, you talk about doing the work you love, and Barney, you call it the prison camp.
Yeah. So these are two different approaches, and they look very different and conflicting at first glance, but I actually think they're more similar than they first appear. So I think, you know, if I was giving someone advice in terms of choosing a career, you can essentially go one of two ways. You can either choose a job that you love, or you can choose a job that pays really, really well. Either of those, to my mind, are rational choices. With the former, you in some ways don't need to get to financial independence ever. If you genuinely have a job that you love and you'd kind of almost do it unpaid, but you get paid for it, that's great. You've solved the puzzle. Unfortunately, the percentage of the population that has a job like that is somewhere around maybe 10%. If you look at surveys of employee satisfaction, the number of people that truly love their work is, that's a small minority. So the alternative is to do what I did, which is to choose a well-paid job. So I didn't end up working in finance by accident. I was like the bank robber. When the bank robber is asked, you know, why do you rob banks? They say, well, that's where the money is. And I worked in finance because that was where the money was. So for me, I chose a slightly different path. I chose a path that would pay me well. But even then, I was still interested in the work. I was still interested in money. I was interested in corporate finance. I was interested in company strategy. I was interested in the valuation of companies. I couldn't have done what I did. I couldn't have ground out a job for 20 years if I'd hated every minute of it. It just would not have been sustainable. So, I mean, although I label it the prison camp, and, you know, it's kind of tongue in cheek, there were lots of things that I didn't like about my job. I didn't like the fact that it was kind of relentless. It was full on. You had to accept, really, that when you're being very well paid, the company essentially, you know, owns your time. And at any moment, you can be asked to drop what you're doing and get on a plane or go back into the office on a weekend. And I had to deal with that. That was the price of the salary that I earned. But I'm a great believer that for some people, that makes sense because they're well paid and they can stomach and maybe even enjoy that sort of work. But I'm a great fan of what Alan's doing, you know, which is helping people create a business that provides them with challenge, meaning, purpose, and may over time lead to much greater earnings. But right now, it can provide them with something to do, with that structure, with that challenge, and with money.
It crosses my mind that practically the opposite of a job that you love is not so much a job that you hate, but that a job that you tolerate. And I think that's where a lot of us find. We find a job that pays well that we can tolerate. I think that's probably the course that many people end up choosing. But then if that's where you find yourself, isn't it a tragedy to have nothing to show for just tolerating that job? If you're paycheck to paycheck in a job that you merely tolerate, what a tragedy.
I completely agree with that. So for me, I talked about those two different routes that made sense. So get a low paid job that you love. So, okay, be a nurse, be a teacher, be a kind of struggling actor. You love it. You know, you don't get paid well, perhaps, but you're getting that joy, that fulfillment, that meaning, that purpose. That makes sense to me. That makes perfect sense to me. Equally, working in finance and pulling down a big salary and banking those bonuses because you know that there's an end in sight, that's a rational strategy to me. What's insane is that middle ground where you just get a kind of an office job that you can tolerate and it slowly eats away at your soul, but there's no escape route from it. There's no end in sight and there's nothing to show for it. That's madness.
Barney, I love the way your mind works. It's almost identical to how I think about it, which is the strategic standpoint. And both of those, you're absolutely right. They are perfectly rational. I chose certainly the latter, where I found a job that paid pretty well and I could tolerate, but it was with the goal of getting out as soon as I could. So I think in perfect world scenario, I would have loved my job. But yeah, unfortunately, that wasn't to be. But now it's in the past. And that was a rational strategy for me. So it worked out quite, quite well. Alan, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this topic as well.
So I guess my thoughts are, it makes perfect sense to go and get a job that earns you lots of money. So I don't think it's always mutually exclusive. I do think you can find work that you love that does pay well. There are people who do it. It's just not the norm. I do think a lot of people just settle, and they settle for, these are the only jobs that are around me, or these are the only jobs that I can find. And there's always other options, such as creating your own work, moving to a different place, finding a company that truly believes in stuff you find. I don't think they're totally mutually exclusive. I think it's rarer than finding a job you can tolerate and making lots of money. I do think it is possible to make money doing something you actually enjoy. And I think it's out there if you work towards it and you search for it. What you and Barney have both said is totally logical. And there are times where if you want to be a zookeeper, you know you're going to take a pay cut. You know you're not going to earn that much money, but you love what you do, so you don't care.
Alan is my UK spirit brother. We're the eternal optimist. You can just hear it coming through. Everything is awesome.
It's interesting because I did what I did. I worked for 20 years in finance. That was often quite challenging, quite stressful. You know, that's why I kind of label it the prison camp. That was my reality. And so I just was not aware of really the world of entrepreneurship, the world of flexible working, the world of freelancing, the world of, you know, interim employment, the world of kind of mini retirements or gap years. That just wasn't my reality. I was very much head down, focus on making bank and investing that money. So for me, it's just been a really fun, interesting, fascinating journey in the 3 years since financial independence to learn some of the stuff that Alan teaches about how it is possible to create a job for yourself, a mini business for yourself that not only provides you with fun and meeting people and interaction and a reason to get up in the morning, but also some money as well. So for me, that is just something that I'm learning about more recently, but it's absolutely fascinating.
And Barney, I think me and you operate from the same place in that we want to know, what is that fixed path? My lack of creativity in my case prevents me from seeing all the infinite number of possibilities to produce income that can allow me to achieve, or at least in the past, achieve financial independence. But I think there's still room for us logical forward thinkers in this space, especially once you get closer to FI or once you're at FI, you can actually start giving that creative place in your mind a little bit more room to breathe because you have that freedom to fail, right? You can now imagine, okay, let's say I take the less optimized path and I pursue this entrepreneurial passion project, potentially zero upshot if it doesn't work out. Even if it goes south, because I tolerated my high-paying gig for long enough, I'm still going to be good to go.
That is spot on. So for my 20 years as an accountant, I think it's fair to say that I was not famed for creativity, okay? And so I didn't exercise my creativity muscle. I didn't, creative writing was not something I did. Podcasting was not something I did. Kind of thinking about, you know, how to tell a story and marketing. Those were not the primary focus of my job. You know, there was some part of that in winning clients. But my point is that I would have said to you maybe 5 years ago, I'm not a creative person, because that was not what I was focusing on at work. And so I underestimated what was possible when you have time and headspace, as you just mentioned. That's absolutely right. You know, when you have more headspace, then your creativity can kind of flourish. You can develop that latent skill. Creativity flourishes from a place of being, you know, relaxed, well-rested, kind of engaged with the world, happy with yourself, happy with what you're doing. If you have those things down, you will find that you're capable of much more creativity than you realized. And for me, one of the things that inhibited my creativity was this fear of failure, this fear of poverty, this fear of kind of silly fear of, you know, ending up being homeless. If that fear is taken away, if you've addressed that point, okay, you know that you're not ever going to be homeless, right? You've paid your mortgage off, so they can't take the house from you. So, okay, we've addressed that point. If you then have a base level of passive income that's paying your grocery bill, well, now I'm not going to be homeless and now I'm not going to starve to death. Okay. With that knowledge, you have the freedom to spend the time, take the risks that are involved in moving job, taking a big, big pay cut, or starting a business from scratch. So kind of the analogy I use is like rock climbing. I mean, if you learned rock climbing without a safety harness, is a very dangerous occupation and you can kill yourself. But rock climbing with a safety harness frees you to relax, to learn, to take chances and tackle more difficult slopes because you've got that safety harness. And so you can just push yourself so much more.
Barney, you just said one of the most important things I've heard on the 60 odd episodes of this podcast. And I really want to take a second to highlight it. You said, I underestimated what was possible. And I really want the audience to take that in because you're talking about those limiting beliefs, right? You were sitting in this job and fear held you back. You had the worry of going back to your childhood of not having a house and you didn't know what creativity was inside of you. And I've used almost the exact same words. I've said, I was the least likely entrepreneur. And thinking back, I'm not so sure that that's accurate because I was always a broad thinker. I was always involved in things, but frankly, I was stuck and I was stuck in this job. And while financial independence was on the horizon, it wasn't as rapidly approaching as I would have liked. And there's that fear that maybe you're not going to ever express what's in there. And I really want to take a second and make sure everybody knows you have a lot of value and a lot of creativity in there. You just need to find a way to express it. And that's something that Alan comes in handy for, right? Alan's constantly talking about ways to enjoy what you do, ways to start up a side hustle that costs very little money. This all ties together. And Alan, I'd love your thoughts on that.
So I love the analogy that Barney just used of climbing with a safety harness. I think if you've got some cash in the bank and you've got a house paid off, it's a lot easier to be creative and go out there. There is another side to this as well, though. You've heard of the burning the boats analogy. If you throw yourself into entrepreneurship and make it your only choice, you'll figure out how to make it happen. I think everyone is born creative. It's letting it out and not stopping the job and the different things, allowing you to be creative as you get older. We're all born creative. It's just letting it out. And I think Barney's exactly right about that.
That's a really interesting point, which is if you're middle class, middle income, if you've been to college, in some ways, the problem that you have is you have that safe option. You have that option to be a lawyer or an accountant or a doctor or you know, something safe. And that therefore removes your impetus, the pressure on you to be entrepreneurial. If you didn't have that safe route available to you, then Alan's absolutely right. You would be forced to be creative. You would be forced to develop those new skills. You'd be forced to take some new steps. And in some ways, early career success in a relatively safe occupation can be a trap because what's happening is you're being acclimatized to a regular monthly salary, which is incredibly comforting. That leads to a bunch of behaviors around not putting that at risk. So compliance, agreeing with your boss, agreeing with your peers, not creating waves, not speaking out maybe when you perhaps perhaps could or should. And so the frog is gently boiled in the pan. And if you spend, the problem with that is if you spend 30 years doing that and then the situation changes, the game changes, your employer just decides you're now, you know, no longer required. If you have allowed your creativity and your other skills to wither, then you're screwed if you don't have that financial safety harness.
And I would say that there's another dimension to the complexity of that trap just due to student loans, because yes, you are fixed on that paycheck, but the other half of that is you are potentially complacent about the slow paying down of those student loans, which is also keeping you potentially trapped and raising the risk of you pursuing something that does have more of an entrepreneurial bent.
Debt ensnares you. Debt enslaves you. That debt is a form of handcuffs that keeps you to a certain lifestyle. That may not be how it was designed, but that is how it operates. I'm a huge believer in paying off debt. Even now, when interest rates are low and you can borrow cheaply, etc., debt always comes with a visible cost, you know, the interest rate payment, but it also comes with an invisible cost. So Steve Bidoff has a fantastic phrase for this. So he says, the way he puts it is, you know, imagine you're a young guy and you want to borrow money to buy your first house. So you put a tie on and you sort of trot along to the bank and you talk to the bank manager, and he says, great, yeah, we'll lend you this money. All you have to do is fill in these forms. But then something unexpected happens. You know, the bank manager reaches into one of his drawers and he pulls out a jar, and you have to, if you want the mortgage, leave a testicle behind as security, as security for the loan. And the way Steve Bidoff tells the story is that now, at any point in the future, if you want to make a brave decision, if you want to make a risky decision, if you want to take a year off, if you want to start your own business, you won't do it because you won't have the balls to do it. And so, you know, he describes a mortgage as something that entraps and emasculates you.
So, Alan, let's hop into maybe some of the more nuances of maybe the UK situation versus what you might see here in the States. And in particular, why don't we start with housing? Because I know that you do have somewhat of a unique housing situation, which can potentially be slightly more problematic for someone pursuing FI. I'd love to get your take on that.
So housing is a fascinating one. The general advice in the UK is leverage yourself as highly as possible to get as big a house as possible when you first start. And that's the advice we were given. That's the advice that lots of friends are given. And the price of housing in the UK, depending on area, can be significant. So I live sort of outside London by about 50 minutes on the train, and my two-bed flat, two-bed apartment costs around £250,000. If you then move slightly further into somewhere like Guildford, that same flat would cost you £500,000. And then if you moved even further into, say, West London, where my brother is living, that same flat would then cost you £800,000 to £900,000. And that particular item, depending on where you live, that will change your attitude as to whether you rent, whether you buy, whether it's worth it. And the growth of house prices down south in the UK compared to up north has been absolutely phenomenal. So there's a massive variance, and there's no one uniform answer to housing. It really depends on where you want to live and how much you've got to spend.
Alan, have you done a rent versus buy calculation as far as like where you live, and how does that generally fall on the spectrum of what makes sense financially, and also in terms of what you're talking about societally, where they're arguing for people to buy? Are there opportunities to rent for less?
So in our particular area, which is Basingstoke in Hampshire, inspired by Jim Collins, we did a rent versus buy calculation, and we are better off buying because the price of housing in Basingstoke is quite low for what you get. So we're better off buying. But the further you travel into London, it goes the other way and it changes. There are plenty of opportunities to rent. There are plenty of places available to rent. The part here is the societal pressure to buy. We have lots of sayings like an Englishman's castle is his home. We're very proud of home ownership. Compared to Europe, we have massive high levels of home ownership, and it's not always the best answer. It depends on where you live within the country.
in the United States, it is probably the number one metric that we use to define a certain level of financial success. So we obviously can identify with what you're saying. Barney, what's your take on the housing situation?
So that idea of property ownership being the dream, that is perhaps even stronger in the UK than it is in the US. That's how strong it is over here. It's a part of the culture. So if you look, you know, RTV, for example, has endless property porn shows, you know, shows like Location, 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 Escape to the Country. And they're all kind of predicated on the idea that happiness comes from having a big house, having perhaps multiple houses, perhaps having holiday homes. And, you know, this goes back a very long way in kind of British society, this idea of, you know, being the lord of the manor, being someone with this big detached house and grounds. That was how you signaled status in Britain for thousands and thousands of years. And so, you know, we've got this culture of property ownership and the idea that that's how you display your wealth. But also we've just got, it's not just a cultural issue in the UK, it's a small island with a lot of people in. You can't escape supply and demand. And there is no doubt that property is one of the biggest challenges to financial independence. It's one of the things that makes it harder in the UK, I think, is cracking that property conundrum. Now, in terms of what I did, when I first moved to London, I moved as close as possible to my work so that I could walk to work. But I also lived in what you might politely describe as a frontier area of London at that point in time. So, you know, it was not a place where middle-class professionals aspired to live. You know, it wasn't the equivalent maybe of kind of Harlem in the 70s, but it was definitely edgy. That was Bethnal Green in London's East End. But since then, the situation's got harder, I think, for FI seekers, because London and the Southeast prices have gone up and up and up. And a number of those kind of frontier areas have become gentrified and become expensive. So if I was starting my journey today, I would actually look at some more kind of interesting, maybe even more kind of extreme options for property. So for example, there's a company over here that does property guardianship, which, so in return for very, very cheap below market rents in some amazing locations, you know, in London, you essentially live and keep a property occupied because it's more effective than them boarding it up and putting guards on it and securing it for 5 months until the redevelopment kicks off. So if you're prepared to be flexible and a little bit different and a little bit innovative, there are always ways to get the same thing for less and to crack that property issue, but you're going to have to be flexible to do that. So you're going to need a kind of powerful motivation to do that.
I absolutely love that flexible way around doing property. It's an incredible way to get the same thing for less. Just adding in, the one piece of advice that made a massive impact on my wife and I as we bought ours was the Robert Kiyosaki, the difference between an asset and a liability. An asset puts money in your product, a liability strips money out of your product. And he said, when thinking about your home, buy as small a liability as possible because your home strips money out of your pocket. And that has been ringing in our ear ever since and is why we still live in a two-bed flat.
So if I was to give you a very simple kind of easy to visualize example, if I was just leaving college and moving to London for the first time now, what I would try and do was find a house, like a townhouse in Mayfair or Westminster or one of these expensive areas, and see if you could just offer the Russian billionaire or the Chinese kind of businessman who lives there, if you could offer them to be their live-in housekeeper while they're away 50 weeks of the year, could you get that kind of amazing, you know, London pad for either for nothing or for a kind of peppercorn rent? And so that's a tough ask. You know, that's not an easy thing to achieve. I'm not saying that can be the answer for everyone, but you need, if you're serious about getting to financial independence, you need that flexibility, that creativity, and that ability to kind of think a bit differently. And even if you don't don't do that extreme route that I kind of talked about. Alan's absolutely right. You know, if it were me starting again, I would get on the, I would look to get on the property ladder, but with the smallest kind of studio flat that I possibly could. And I would reframe people's view about, you know, sharing with flatmates. There's this idea that people often just don't think about the benefits of sharing a flat or sharing a house with other people. It's kind of, people kind of look down on that a bit. It's like, oh, can't you afford your own place? But again, it's there's a community benefit. There's a kind of a security benefit to it. You know, I lived for many years in shared flats, you know, with friends, and it was fun.
And I think what I love about this conversation is you're talking about this idea of doing this guardianship, and we have Alan, who is like the essence of the pop-up business, right? Right here listening to this, and you know his mind is spinning with ideas. My mind is spinning with ideas. I'm thinking right now, I'm going to go get guardian.weebly.com. I'm going to go get a headshot. I'm going to go get my whole, you know, certified background check put up on there with a resume of all my abilities when it comes to home maintenance. And I'm going to go to Channel 4 News or whatever the local TV station is and talk about this service that I offer and how it's transforming the world and really making life easier for these people that have this estate in this area that they can't maintain, how much savings it is over what it would cost to put guards up. And I've got publicity, which instantly gives me credibility. I've got exposure because I've got my Weebly account, and I'm in business and I'm living free. Potentially with Alan's model, I might even get paid on top of that going forward. It changes the game, right? Alan, tell me I'm wrong.
I'm telling you, you're exactly right. I love that. And I love how you see a business in every opportunity now. I do too. Even if you don't see a business, there's a way to get a home to live in by doing exactly what Barney said. And by being creative, you can get to FI twice as fast as your average person.
So for this next line item, I think one of the things we should obviously contrast is healthcare. And one of the reasons it's important to contrast it is that it is a train wreck in the United States. We do have answers. They're not great answers, but we do have ways that you can navigate those lanes. But it's clearly in flux. And I know that in the UK, you've had a system in place for a long time now. And Barney, would you like to tell us about how it would basically work?
So just like housing is a thing that makes getting to financial independence in the UK harder, the healthcare situation, I think, is more favorable. It makes it easier in the UK. So just, you know, very simply, the US, I think, spends about 18% of GDP on healthcare. The UK spends about 9%. So we spend about half as much on healthcare, and we get pretty decent outcomes for a much lower expenditure. So we have the National Health Service. The National Health Service covers everyone. You don't need to pay. If you need something urgently, they will provide that for you for free. And so it just takes it off the table in terms of being something that you need to worry about when leaving a job. Now, you still have private health insurance in the UK because people don't want to go on a waiting list for an operation. So you can still get private health insurance that will allow you to go private and get an operation immediately. But I would argue you don't even need that. If you're on the path to financial independence, you can essentially self-insure. So all of the really bad stuff is covered by the NHS and will cover you immediately. But you also, if you have this kind of stash, you have this freedom fund that gives you the option, should you ever want to get to go private, you can just buy the healthcare, you know, as and when you want. So it's just not really an issue in the UK.
So Barney, with NHS, this is just fully included as part of just being a citizen, correct? Like you obviously pay your taxes and that funds it, but you don't have to send any payments in. You don't have to fill out forms each year. I mean, am I correct with this? This is just like a part of being a British citizen.
It's just like free education, free healthcare. You know, if you're sick and you just turn up at accident and emergency, you know, you're our equivalent of the ER, you'll get seen. You don't need any papers. You'll just get seen.
That sounds a lot simpler. You know, if we're going to talk about these maybe stark differences, one of the things I want to talk about is investing. And I think what's interesting is it isn't necessarily as different as one would suspect at face value. Alan, do you want to talk for a few minutes about your approach to investing in the UK?
Absolutely. And it's not that different. However, when you're first starting out and you're listening to fabulous American podcasts like Choose FI or reading Jim Collins's site or reading Tony Robbins' book, there is some translation you need to do to English. I know we both speak the same language, but we don't at times. And you have to do a little bit of translation. Basically, we have two main vehicles that you can do tax advantage savings in. An ISA, which is an individual savings account, where you pay the tax on the way in, but you don't pay the tax on the way out. And then we have pensions or SIPs, which you don't pay the tax on the way in, but you pay the tax on the way out. Both of those are tax advantage accounts. The one tip I really want to give people in England that took a long time for us to work out was you can invest directly in Vanguard, and they do now have some different things that you can invest directly in Vanguard, and Vanguard will allow you to invest in an ISA. Actually, what we've discovered is actually cheaper to invest through a third party in the UK. So we did some sums, and most of the places you invest in the UK will charge you an annual management fee as a percentage. So Vanguard charge a percentage. Other providers like Charles Stanley provide a percentage as well. And if you've got 10 grand, they take a percent of that or whatever it is. We actually found that Halifax charge a flat fee for your ISA. So they'll charge you £12.50 a year. So compared to one of the previous ones we were using, my wife and I did a little spreadsheet to work out the management charges over a 20-year investing period. And we saved £40,000 over that 20-year period by investing through Halifax into Vanguard funds rather than a Charles Stanley or some of the other ones. So you've got to pay attention to the fees, and we have all our money invested in Vanguard through Halifax.
Yeah, it's amazing how it always comes down to the fees. That's what we're constantly talking about and why we are such proponents of Vanguard generally. But yeah, we will certainly link to Halifax in the show notes. So yeah, that's very valuable information, Alan. And Barney, I'm curious your thoughts on investing.
So just on that point around percentage fees or fixed fees, I just tell people over and over again, if you're serious about financial independence, when you see something quoted to you as a percentage of funds under management, you should run in the opposite direction if you have that option. So for me, I do not invest with a platform, with a broker that charges me a percentage of my portfolio value. It makes no sense whatsoever. I'm using a fixed cost base. I'm using their infrastructure. Why should they charge me extra? Why should I pay them extra just because there's a few, it's bigger numbers. They're not doing a different job. So, I mean, I use the Share Center as my main platform and online broker. And as Alan says, it's fixed fees. It doesn't vary on your based on your portfolio value. Over the years, that will save you thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds.
We're big fans of just VTSAX, just as something that we end up pointing to a lot. Not necessarily that that's the only index fund to use, but just it's kind of one that we tend to highlight. For you guys, my understanding is Vanguard does have a couple funds, Alan, that you're a fan of, or do you use a different index?
So I definitely invest with Vanguard, following Jim Collins and your advice and all the others. Vanguard is the one we go to. I do not invest entirely in America. I'm more globally split. I don't also invest entirely in the UK because I think that would be daft. The UK is around about 8% of the global market at the moment. And actually, American market is around about 60%. And our investment more or less mirrors the world split of economies. So we have around about 8% in the FTSE UK fund. And then we have the rest of our money in the developed world, excluding the UK, which is 60% US, and then models Australia, Europe, Canada, Japan, and the other developed nations. So our money is just split globally around the world. I don't kind of follow Jim's advice to only invest in the US. I think that's primarily because I'm not based there, but we are majority 60% in the US.
I believe in the UK, you guys do have this marginal tax bracket as well, which means that those pre-tax vehicles really do hold some significant appeal, especially when you're moving from these high income years to potentially this financial independence period where your life is much more efficient and usually cost less.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're in the higher tax brackets, that can be 40 to 45%. Tax, which is a massive chunk of everything you earn. So if you're investing that into a pension, you get that money back and you pay the tax later, hopefully when you're paying less. So it can be a fantastic advantage.
if the higher marginal tax bracket that you can find yourself in during your working years is 40 to 50%, what tax bracket, what marginal tax bracket would you try to land in as a target goal during your 5 years?
So the way the tax works in the UK on income tax is you currently this year, you get your 2017, you get your first £11,000 tax-free. The 20% tax bracket then extends up to 45, and then you pay 40% above that up until 150, and then 45% above that. If you're on a salary from a company, you don't have much choice other than to just pay the tax bracket that you're in. The same thing if you're self-employed. If you're a company, you have slightly different abilities to defer the tax to different years. Me personally, I try to remain under the 40% tax bracket each year so that I don't pay too much and I defer the tax to later on.
And is there any difference between how income is taxed and how capital gains or earnings are taxed for you guys?
Absolutely. It's very similar to the US. We have capital gains and you get a personal allowance and you can combine that with your partner to give you a bigger allowance. Then you also have your income tax, which is a completely separate thing.
Okay, so it's separated out. What is the tax rate on capital gains?
I'm going to have to Google that now. Tax-free allowance is 11,300, but I have not worked out how to do that tax-free harvesting in the UK. I'd be interested to know if Barney's worked it out. I've heard everyone talk about how amazing it is, but I've not worked out how to do it in the UK yet.
Yeah, I mean, I do that. So you can, as Alan says, you have a capital gains allowance of 11,000. And also, if you're married, your spouse has one. And you can always transfer assets from one spouse to the other to ensure that you use both of your allowances. So if you had a gain of £20,000, that would exceed your own capital gains allowance. So you can either harvest along the way, or you can transfer the asset or half of the asset into your spouse's name and utilize their allowance as well. So there are things that you can do to shelter assets from capital gains tax. But even if you don't, it's a much lower rate than on income. So if you pay higher rate income tax, you pay only 20% on your gains from chargeable assets.
Okay. That was the last piece. So I think that's useful. All right. What I wanted to move to is just talking just for a few minutes about how the social attitudes towards FI are different in the UK as to what we see here in the United States. Now, make no mistake, this is a subculture, even in the United States, but it does seem that we have a lot more traction than you guys are seeing in the UK. I mean, Barney, to be honest, yours is the first FI blog in the UK that I've stumbled upon. It doesn't appear that there is any sort of tangible movement, at least up to this point in the UK. Is that what you're seeing as well?
Absolutely. So look, there are other blogs, but what I'm talking about is a broader kind of lack of awareness or a broader lack of an infrastructure or a community or an awareness of the concept. And so I was very struck. I mean, I spent a bit of time on holiday and on business in the US, and immediately you're struck by the differences when you go over there. And there is this tradition in the US of the frontier settlers. There is a tradition of self-reliance. There is a suspicion of overpowerful central government. There is a tradition of personal freedom. There is a constitution where those freedoms are written down, spelt out, and, you know, enforced through the legal system. And in the UK, it's the attitudes are different. We do not have the same kind of suspicion of central government. We don't have the same suspicion of large institutions. And so there's just less emphasis, I think, on individual freedom, you know, slightly less emphasis, I think, on entrepreneurship, although, you know, that has improved over the last 20 years or so. And there just isn't this kind of idea that, you know, ultimately, you know, pursuing personal freedom is an important life goal, which you can achieve through management of your personal finances. Again, in the US, as popular and as great as, you know, Mr. Money Moustache and Early Retirement Extreme are, they didn't invent this stuff. There is a longer tradition in the US that you can kind of trace back to Thoreau and, you know, the book Walden Pond and those social and political and constitutional differences in the U.S.
Now, having said that, you did recently have a TV show that highlighted the subculture in the UK, and you were actually featured in that TV show. And so at some level, the mainstream is aware of this. Is that right?
I briefly appeared. There was a program on Channel 4 that aired in July called How to Retire at 40. And so, you know, there is a lot of attention in the UK on pensions, the problems with saving for a pension. And generally, that's, if you read the mainstream media, which I don't advise you to do, there's this kind of endlessly negative drumbeat of how difficult and impossible and it is, and you might as well just give up. So that there is a lot of media coverage on the issue of retirement, and Channel 4 made this show called How to Retire at 40. And, you know, I appeared on that for about 30 seconds. And I guess that was perhaps the first time that someone had spoken about the concept of financial independence on TV. But it's a very alien concept in the UK. And other than that one kind of instance, it's just not something that's had media coverage at all.
So when I was preparing for the show, I actually was able to find that feature and watch part of it. And it struck me that even the reporters that were interviewing you and talking to a few other people just didn't get it. And they weren't able to act as caretakers of that message because, frankly, they were still in the process of digesting it. It was almost overwhelming for them. And I think that came through in the show, that it was just this quote unquote weird thing that a few people were doing.
Yeah, I mean, I have some sympathy for the producers. There are pressures upon them to create a show with mainstream appeal. Otherwise, they won't get it commissioned. So in some ways, they had to kind of look for hooks and angles and quirks that they thought would make it more accessible to a mainstream audience. So they had people who had just started businesses. They had people that were sharing a mortgage to buy a house together, not, you know, which are all perfectly sensible, but not really directly related to financial independence as we would understand it, you know, that sort of engineering your lifestyle around being able to achieve freedom with a fair degree of certainty in a limited number of years. So it's not an easy show to make, I think, for a mainstream audience. So we'll see if someone has another go at it.
And Barney, what was the general reception to that show as far as, I don't know if you followed along with comments on the internet or any reception to the actual program on television? I'd love to hear about it.
Well, it got quite a bit of press coverage, and the press coverage was informative, slightly depressing, but informative. So there's a very big newspaper over here called the Daily Mail, and there's a wonderful couple called Jason and Julie who also briefly appeared on the show, and they got to financial independence about the age of 40, and they've spent the last few years just traveling around Europe in a camper van. And they came from working class backgrounds. They didn't make big salaries. I mean, their story is very inspiring, and what they did is very impressive. Their story was written up in the Daily Mail, and I made the mistake of looking at the comments section, and it was a cesspit of haters. You know, there were, I think, almost 1,000 comments, and very few of them were positive. For some reason, that sparked a kind of wave of negativity. And I'm not entirely sure why, you know, why people, you know, maybe it's envy of the kind of lifestyle that those guys are now living, or I don't know exactly what it is, but I was very struck by that negative reaction.
So to each of you, and maybe Alan, let me start with you. I would be very curious. Let's say this episode became part of a series called The UK Path to FI. And going back to Sarah's initial voicemail, what would be your takeaway that you want someone that has never heard of FI before, but is listening to this episode because someone mentioned it to them and they're just now hearing about the concept? What is that takeaway that you want that person to hear?
The takeaway message I want people to hear is it's possible to do it in England. You can buy back decades of your life by getting on with the FI path. It's just as simple as it is in America. You can invest in a low-cost index fund like Vanguard, save your money, reduce your spending. You can get to FI. It is possible in the UK to do it. Just get on with it.
And Barney?
I'm fortunate because I actually, because by writing the blog and also I see coaching clients. And so I see the most amazing range of people doing this, doing it now. It's not just people with very high incomes. I think there's often a view that it's only for people in the software industry or it's only or the tech industry or it's only for people in finance in the UK. But I have seen people from all walks of life do this stuff. So it is possible. The similarities between the US and the UK in respect to financial independence are much greater than the differences. They're much greater than differences. And from an investing point of view, it really couldn't be simpler. You guys have Vanguard over there. We've got Vanguard over here. It's the easiest thing in the world just to choose a global tracker fund with low fees, low charges, and use that as your vehicle for growing wealth and creating what I call a compounding machine. So the differences in terms of terminology are trivial. The fundamental principles apply equally in the UK and much of the rest of the developed world as they do in the US.
People are going to want to find you guys and connect with you guys. And I know what I love about that sentence is that I know how passionate both of you are seeing this community grow in the UK and London and in your respective cities. But what is the best way for people to connect with you? And let me preface this by saying, Alan, if you're hearing Alan for the first time, we interviewed him on episode 30. Which was talking about this idea of entrepreneurship, multiple income streams, starting a passion project. You need to go listen to that episode. It's amazing. But Alan, what is the best way for someone to reach you?
They can reach me through my website, popupbusinessschool.co.uk, or send me a message on Twitter at Alan Donegan.
And Barney, your blog is at theescapeartist.me. What is the best way for people to reach you?
Yeah, so check out the website, and on the website there's my email address, there's my Twitter account there. So just go to theescapeartist.me and you can get hold of me there.
Now, before we let you go, Alan, you don't get a second shot at the hot seat, but Barney, we would love to offer you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Have you heard our hot seat yet?
Oh, maybe not.
Okay. Oh, you'd remember it.
bring it on.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
I love it.
Question number one, your favorite blog that's not your own.
Okay. Well, look, I have to start with the almost obligatory reference to Mr. Money Moustache. For my money, that is kind of the most engaging and kind of entertaining blog out there. And it was hugely valuable for me in my journey. But I would like to give a shout out to, there's a blog called Moneyvator in the UK. And the guys that write that have been doing a fantastic job just plowing a lonely furrow often for the last 10 years in teaching people about investing and just raising even the possibility, the concept of financial independence. And then finally, the other one I'd mention that isn't really a financial independence blog per se, but the James Altucher blog, you know, Altucher Confidential, that I love the kind of brutal, raw honesty when he talks about all his screw-ups and his mistakes. And I think that's a blog that's really written from a good place.
Yeah, I listen to his podcast actually on a weekly basis, but I've actually never read the blog, so I should definitely check that out. All right, Barney, question number two, your favorite article of all time, and this could be either something you've written or something you've read on another site?
So I've got two favorite articles, and they're both on my website, but I didn't write either of them. So the first one is called An Interview with the Man, that was written by David Kane from Raptitude. And it's just the blog post that I wish I'd written. It's absolutely hilarious and just insightful at the same time. It's a notional interview with the man, you know, the owner of the system and who is reputed to kind of hold us all down. So that's just hilarious. And that's on my blog. David gave me permission to republish that. And then the other one that I love is called A Diamond's a Girl's Best Friend, which was written by Helen from Free to Pursue. And to me, the example of engagement rings is just one of the most kind of striking examples of the madness of consumer society. So this idea that you need to show your love by spending, you know, whatever, £5,000 or £10,000 on a bit of glass that is indistinguishable from cubic zirconia is just madness. And it's very easy for me as a guy to say that. And people are kind of, yeah, well, you would say that, you're just a cheapskate. What I love is the fact that it's written by Helene, a lady who advocates for not spending those crazy amounts of money on a product from a cartel. So those would be my two favorite articles.
And Barney, I actually want to plug one more article that you wrote. I wanted to save this, print it out and print it on my wall, but the title of it was The Aggregation of Marginal Gains. And I would love for you, I almost think it's an entire episode, but I would love just to hear your synopsis of that article.
So the problem when you try and explain financial independence to, you know, a friend or a colleague is they can't wrap their heads about how, you know, stashing an amount of money where you'd never need to work again, how could that even be possible? And so if you give them an example of something that you do to save money, like, I don't know, you say, I take my lunch into work rather than buy an expensive sandwich, they're just going to look at you and think, what on earth, man? Like, how is that ever going to add up to an amount of money where I don't ever have to work again? So the aggregation of marginal gains is a phrase that I stole from one of the top sports coaches in the UK, a guy called Dave Brailsford, who runs the Sky cycling team and the British Olympic cycling team. And he turned Britain from a country where cycling was, if not unknown, was unpopular and we were terrible at it in international competitions, to a situation where we won the most gold medals at the Olympics and, you know, we've won the Tour de France multiple times. And this phrase just refers to the fact that by doing everything just a bit better, the compound effect of all of those different improvements adds up and it multiplies over time. And so, you know, in cycling, he gives the example of one of the things that the cyclists do is when they're on Tour de France, they take their own pillow with them to a hotel. And just having your own pillow means you're more likely to get a great night's sleep. Therefore, you're more likely to perform better the next day in the race. And, you know, when he explains this, you know, you get this incredulous reaction at first from the interviewer saying, well, how can that possibly win you the Tour de France? And the answer is, of course, that on its own, it can't. But what he's looking for is that little edge, that little incremental performance benefit in every aspect of nutrition, training, equipment and clothing and the training schedule of the athlete. And that's directly analogous to financial independence. There's no one magic bullet. It's about getting everything a little cheaper. It's about earning more. It's about squeezing your fees when you're investing. And it's the compound effect of putting all of those marginal gains together that's so powerful.
Barney, that's incredible because I literally was just reading an article about the British cyclists and the Tour de France and these marginal gains. It was actually on jamesclear.com and the article was called "This Coach Improved Every Tiny Thing by 1% and Here's What Happened." And that's incredible. I was reading this just in the past couple of days and I meant to link to it in our Facebook group because I agree that it's so analogous to financial independence that if you can just improve things and just constantly look in your life for ways to improve, not just with finances, with saving time, with saving stress, with getting more physically fit, just every single thing you can do to improve, learning something new, learning something in a completely new field, just even the Cliff Notes versions, like you just become a more valuable person. And these things do compound over time. So absolutely fascinating. And we will link to all those articles in the show notes.
Yeah. And when I was reading that, Barney, you were talking about articles you wish you had written. That was the article I wish I had written. And it confirms for me that FI is so much more than packing your lunch and taking it with you to work. It's an entire life optimization strategy that, as Brad was just saying, allows you to get better in every single aspect of your life. And I loved it at the end of it. When someone asks you how you hit FI, you say, oh, well, when I travel, I bring my pillow from home.
Yeah. And look, for me as well, there's so much more to financial independence than just the money aspect to it. So look, the money is great. It's lovely to never, you know, be worried about money and to have that, all of those stresses taken away. But once you get to financial independence, you're optimizing for other things. So you're optimizing for happiness, for meaning, purpose, challenge in your life. And those examples of the benefits, for example, of being just getting fitter, that is seriously non-trivial. That changes how you feel. It changes how you relate to other people. It changes how you present. Those small marginal gains that you eke out over time, they just pay you back 100-fold.
Tell you, Brad, that was the entire episode, wasn't it? Like, I literally just condensed the entire episode down to like 5 minutes.
Yeah, we're definitely doing another episode on that for sure.
All right, Barney, question number three, your favorite life hack.
Okay, so favorite life hack, reading books. So reading books is the most kind of powerful, or reading the right books is the most powerful life hack there is, because essentially the deal, if you read the right books, is you take a genius in their field, they condense their life's learning for you. They do all that work for years and years and years in their career. Then they agonize for a couple more years in how to kind of write that down and condense it. And all you have to do is go on Amazon and get it delivered secondhand for a couple of quid, or you get it from the library for free, and you have just sucked from that person the entire wisdom, knowledge, and value that they have spent decades working on. And so if you read the right books and you then kind of implement some of the lessons in your own life, the benefits from that are just ridiculously great.
I agree. That probably is my number one life hack. If I were to really take a step back, I constantly am telling my daughters that the way to get a better life, the way to learn things, the way to become useful in life is to just constantly read. And it strikes me of something that I was reading a book about Charlie Munger, who is Warren Buffett's right-hand man at Berkshire Hathaway. And his family, basically, they call him a book with legs.
Yes.
That's what he looks like to them, because he's sitting in a chair 10 plus hours a day with a book propped in front of his face, and all they see is the book and legs. So that is the way to become intelligent. There's no doubt about it.
And my favorite part of that was just sucking the soul out of the author for a couple quid. I love the perfect selfishness, right, in that statement.
That is brilliant. That is brilliant. You said the right books. What are your top couple books that you would recommend for someone to get a better life, have a better outlook, et cetera? Like, what would you recommend?
I mean, just there is on my blog, there's a page called Life Changing Books. So you can see them all there. And essentially, those are the 20 or so books that provide the intellectual framework for my blog.
What I love about what you do, Barney, is you also go through pop culture, you go through TV shows, and you extract the message that you feel like applies to the FI community. And I think you do that at a deeper level than anybody else that I've seen tackle that. And what I love is your favorite FI show of all time was actually House. And I won't break that down other than let you know I read that, and we'll link to that article in the show notes. People should go check it out if they want to get a list of TV shows that you extracted some FI juice from.
Oh, I mean, the wisdom, the knowledge, you know, the smarts that went into making that show. I mean, that's just sailing over the heads of like 99% of the population. That was an amazing show.
All right, Barney, question number four. What was your biggest financial mistake?
Okay, so that's easy. I've written about this on the blog. So back in 2003, the Iraq war was going on. The stock market had been crashing. It was the tail end of the dot-com boom, or the fallout, the bear market that followed the dot-com boom. And, you know, I had all my money in the stock market, and I had just watched with kind of horror for the best part of 3 years, as almost every day the value of my portfolio went down and down and down and down, until a point at which I could take it no more. And I did, you know, the ultimate rookie mistake in investing, which is I capitulated and I sold all my investments because I just couldn't bear to see it go on anymore. And obviously, by doing that, I called the bottom of the market or almost to the exact week. And so immediately that I'd sold all my investments, the stock market then kind of pivoted and troughed out and started a long 5 or 6 year bull run, much of which I missed out on. And so that was just a ridiculous kind of rookie mistake, which burned and imprinted on my memory, on my consciousness. You never sell in panic. You never capitulate at the bottom of a bear market.
I would imagine that that steal helped you out in 2008 to 2010.
So that was the making of me in 2008 and 2009. So, you know, after Lehman went bust and it looked like the entire banking system of the world was going to topple over and we were all going to go back to living in caves, I knew from my past experience that this too shall pass. And not only did I not sell my investments at that point, every pound that I could scrape together and get my hands on, I put into the stock market at those lows because, and that's a direct learning experience from my ridiculous mistake in 2003.
I want to make a rather obvious actionable takeaway here, but one of the reasons that you capitulated in 2003 was potentially the lack of a community, the lack of resources, the lack of role models. And then in 2008, what you did is you learned from your past mistakes. What's really cool about the idea of reading books and being involved in the FI community is the ability to potentially bypass some of those biggest mistakes and learn and suck the soul from people that have already made it or have already made those mistakes and have then distilled what they could have done better. And potentially the audience that's hearing this for the first time will be steeled for that first crash. And they'll be able to say, look, these were the biggest mistakes and pulling out at the bottom is the worst possible thing I can do. What other choice could I make? And maybe it's to buy more, to be more aggressive. Take your, what's the statement, Brad, that Warren Buffett makes with the Bosch Basin?
Yeah, Buffett said, every decade or so, dark clouds will fill the economic skies and they will briefly rain gold. When downpours of that sort occur, it's imperative that we rush outdoors carrying wash tubs, not teaspoons. And that we will do.
And so it's this idea of replacing fear with opportunity.
Yeah, I love it. You know, and we're kind of due, aren't we? We're kind of due another bear market. So no one knows when that will be, but it will happen at some point. And if I could kind of leave the audience with one message, it would be, you know, be ready for that and don't make the idiotic mistake that I made.
Yeah. And you know what, Barney, that is perfect. I mean, essentially the next thing I was going to ask you would be advice you would give your younger self. I mean, is that it? Is there anything else you want to add to that?
I just, the thing I'd tack on to that is just two words. Which is get better. So there's the idea of reading books, there's the idea of not selling when the stock market crashes. But the most powerful thing that you can kind of ever do is just focus on improving yourself. You can't control other people. You can control yourself. And if you kind of embed into your life a desire for self-improvement and that you action, the rewards from that are almost infinite.
Brad, I feel like I'm talking to you right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, Barney, it's like we're long lost brothers. I mean, I swear everything you're saying, I literally last night was working. I've recently picked up CrossFit, the exercise program CrossFit. Yeah, and yeah. It's such a foreign thing for me. I've never done any weightlifting. And it's frankly, it's very, very difficult for me. And I've always been an athlete. I'm a lifelong soccer player. So I'm the same.
I'm exactly the same.
Nice. So yeah, I mean, but it's just so difficult. And I'm literally in front of my wife and daughter yesterday, I'm practicing in front of a mirror how to do the deadlift form and doing the hip hinge, you know, with no weight and just doing it over and over and over again. And while I look like a crazy person, I realize that this is just about getting better. If that means trying to work on this at 9:30 at night, you know, in front of half my family who's laughing at me, that's fine. That's okay. And also, it really is a great lesson for my daughter, which is, all right, daddy might be good at things. He might have this financial independence. You know, she knows all these things and he's working every day to just get better at something that's completely different from what he normally does. And like, that's just such a cool lesson. And I'm glad that I can model that for my children.
I love that. And actually, when you get to financial independence, you're going to kind of need to keep modeling that. So one of the problems potentially of financial independence is your children are not seeing you kind of go to a conventional job. But that isn't really a problem at all, because there are so many different ways that you can model that idea of, you know, getting better, challenging yourself, working hard, other than just a conventional office job. So I went rock climbing recently with my daughter, and I'm terrified of heights. But I know the beauty of that is she's seeing me tackle my fear. She's seeing me do something out of my comfort zone. She's seeing me do something that I find difficult.
All right, Barney, this is the last question we got for you. This is our bonus question. Your favorite purchase made on Amazon.com, or I guess Amazon. What is it? Would it be .co.uk?
Yeah. So, The Walking Dead on Amazon's Prime streaming service. That I just love that show. I love the deeper kind of hidden meaning to that show. The Walking Dead was originally a comic series that is written as a satire on consumerism. So most people don't know that. If you watch The Walking Dead and you understand that it's a satire on consumerism, it's fascinating. It is also the best illustration of applied evolutionary psychology that you can find anywhere. So that the learnings from The Walking Dead, it's something I've written about on the blog. You know, this, you know, we all have these kind of fears of something bad happening. And that fear is often what stops people from pursuing financial independence or from starting a business or from leaving a job. And if you can understand the evolutionary reason for some of those fears, for me, it makes overcoming them that bit easier.
It strikes me, Brad, that the way that I take in entertainment and media and the way that Barney takes in entertainment, media, and TV are totally different. Like, I'm just consuming the changes in the split screens and the pace of the action and that sort of thing. And Barney consistently extracts the message behind the message, the meta game, if you will.
Yeah, it's absolutely phenomenal. And Barney, I'm going to go and read every single article on your site. So that's probably the next week or two of my life. But thank you in advance. I appreciate it. And yeah, it was absolutely a pleasure having you on, both you and Alan. And this was really wonderful. Thank you for taking the time.
If you guys are ever in London, let me know. It'd be great to have kind of meet up.
We will take you up on that for sure.
Thanks, guys. Cheers.
Well, Alan, Barney, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has just been an absolute blast. And to our audience, thank you for being a part of the Choose FI community. If you want to support us, here are four easy ways. One, leave us an iTunes review. If you want to do that, just go to choosefi.com/iTunes. Two, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to choosefi.com/cards and get started today. Three, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free, and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in cat. And four, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 38, The Why of FI, and right behind that, have them go listen to episode 21, The Pillars of FI. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.